The recordings have now started. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the review of all rights protection mechanisms, RPMs, and all GTLB-PDP working group calls held on Wednesday, 18th of April, 2018. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the WebEx room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? It looks like we have Dale Nelson on the audio bridge only. Also, it looks like Kathy Kleiman is also on the audio bridge only. I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will turn it over to Julie.
Thank you very much, Ashra. And just to that note again, what we were hearing a little bit of background noise. I think it stopped now. We're hearing the background noise, so please let me ask everybody who's not speaking to mute. Thank you very much. And welcome everybody on the call. So let me run through the agenda here briefly, and then we have the various updates from the sub-teams, so we'll move there accordingly. But let me just ask if there are any updates to the statements of interest. Not seeing any hands, so I'm going to think there's no updates there. The next item will be the status reports, but just to run through the program, it'll be status reports. That's the specific recommendations for next steps and timeline from the three URS sub-teams. That's documents, practitioners, and providers. Then discussion slash agreement on the next steps for the three URS sub-teams in view of the current phase one timeline. And then notice of agenda for the 25th April meeting. So does anybody have anything else they want to add to the agenda or any other business? And again, to raise your hand, there's a little hand icon kind of in the bottom.
Hey Julie, this is Phil. We have in the chat, and I noticed as well, at the bottom of the screen it says event recording is paused. Are we recording here or not?
I see that the recording
now it's recording. Okay.
And I do again. Okay. The background noise is. Actually, it's not. Anybody who is not speaking, please do mute your microphones. To mute, just again to look at the lower right of the chat area. There's a thing that looks like a megaphone. If you click on that, that will mute your microphone. Thank you. So we have the updates from the three sub-teams. I noted that we've listed them here as documents, practitioners, and providers. I don't know if we want to go in that order. Let me ask Phil if you have any thoughts or if we want
Julie,
to.
Yeah, Julie, I'm really ready to take over at this point. Kathy and I have discussed this. We're going to start by going through the providers' documents, then the practitioners, and if we have time, we can talk to documents or we can hold that for next week's call, depending on how we're doing on time.
Excellent.
Phil,
thanks
this
so
is
much.
Kathy. I've got my hand raised on this.
Go ahead, Kathy, please.
So with apologies, you'll see a message that just came through. Jason Schaefer, who is the chair of the practitioner subteam, has to leave the call early and was wondering if he could present first.
Okay, Kathy, that's fine. I want to defer to Jason, but let me just say a couple of things.
Sure.
Just to set context for this call, I see now we're have 39 attendees. So what I wanted to say is clearly we've been having discussion on the email list. Some members of the working group want to request a charter change from council regarding how we do the URS. Whether we do that all in this phase one or move it all to phase two or kind of split the baby. The co-chairs are aware of that. We're planning to devote right now, since we have had substantial input, a working group call on that, the first call in May, which if there's support for sending something to council, is sufficient time to get it on council's agenda for their meeting in late May. But the reason I'm mentioning that is because people say, why are we talking about these questions and talking about sending them out to providers and practitioners if we're going to be discussing whether or not URS will be done in phase one? And the answer, at least from the co-chairs, is these sub-teams have done a tremendous amount of work. The work is done. It's ready for review. We have until July when we expect the survey questions from the other issues back to us. So we have time now. So finalizing these questions and getting them out and getting answers back by late May, early June has no effect on the separate question of how we're going to deal with URS. It's we don't want to lose the momentum of the work. If the decision is made to move part or all of the URS policy discussion to phase two, these answers, these questions and answers will be preserved for use at that time. So we didn't. So that's, if anyone has any concerns that moving forward on these questions and getting them answered prejudices the other discussion, that's not the case. And we'll discuss the agenda for the coming 2 weeks calls at the end of this call. But I just wanted to get that out there up front in case anyone had any questions or concerns about that. And I'll see Mr. Kirikos has his hand up. Let's hear from him, and then let's turn it over to Jason to take it through the practitioner questions. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, George Kirikos. I just want to note that we only got the documents in the email from Ariel yesterday, so many of us are seeing these questions from the to the providers and practitioners, et cetera, for the first time only in the past 24 hours. And so I think it's it would make sense to provide more time to finalize the questions rather than just today or next week, because people need sufficient time to review. There was talk about, you know, modifying these questions with great care, but I think it was decided early on that we don't defer to the sub-teams, that ultimately it's the main working group that should be deciding the questions. And while the sub-teams do a lot of work, they're owed no deference. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, George. And in response, it's the co-chair's plan that any discussion of these questions will continue into next week and next week's call, that today's discussion does not close out discussion of their final form. I hope that addresses your concern. They got out yesterday because we gave document sub-team members until late Monday to consider various providers sub-team to deal with some final issues that were discussed last week. So today's call is not the end of discussion, but hopefully we can get a lot done on today's call. And I don't see any other hands up, and I don't see any questions in the chat. So I think if you click on the tab above the window that says Practitioners, you will get to the URS Practitioner Background Experience and Perspective. These are questions put together by that sub-team, and Jason Schaefer, I believe, is ready to take us through these questions. So I turn it over to you, Jason.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you, everyone. As we've discussed, this has been a long process to get here. Those of you there at the meeting in Puerto Rico, we presented the sub-team interim report, took feedback from the Puerto Rico meeting, and then when we went back to our sub-team calls, it was further decided on the sub-team that we would actually break out and do a smaller group of volunteers to help take further feedback, make sure that we could get the questions in good working order, which I hope you will agree when you read through these with me. You'll see that they have come a long way from the original discussions. And our goal was to, you know, make this a document that was manageable for the party that is receiving the questions and try to encourage them to respond and have thoughtful responses and give us some useful data. Obviously, we needed to balance that with ensuring that we covered topics that would also help inform our discussion on the URS. So as you can see on the first page, we have a couple questions that are intro questions. I want to first thank George, Petter, and Scott, Scott Austin, who were working with me on the volunteer group. George took lead on helping reformat some of these questions. Also, Greg Shatton had some influence, a lot of influence in getting these to final form. So everyone on our sub-team were very satisfied with the results that the group put together. Yes, it's not George Kirkos. It's George Nachivansky. So with that, I guess we can start. If you all have on screen, you'll see question 1, 2, and 3. Those are pretty straightforward questions. One thing I will note is as you go through the questions, you'll see where we put this into a format that just encouraged a multiple choice answer, A, B, C, D, E. It was George felt that, since Survey Monkey type of approach, better to have some multiple choice answers where necessary or where we thought it would be useful to help inform the discussion. We're going to have text boxes, and in certain sections you'll see later a requirement that you explain the basis for your answer when we get into more substantive points, such as dealing with the standard of proof and other topics. Any questions on how we got here or the background? Okay. Julie, I guess you're going to be able to move these slides forward. Okay. You'll see on screen, it looks like we're getting cut off, but question 4 is the first question where we get into procedural issues where we have ABC as a topic question point, and then there's a requirement to explain your issue. That the question, and I'll read it if you can't see it on screen, it looks like, is when involved as a complainant or its representative in a URS proceeding, were there any issues with delivering notice of the proceeding to the respondent? We thought that was an important question because to actually have some additional textual response because it seems that practitioners have run into issues, potential issues in getting notice to respondents, and we wanted to understand what those issues might be rather than just leave it as a yes or no response. Okay, Julie, if you move on. Okay, question 6, 7, 8, again, Brian, that looks like has a question. Go ahead, Brian.
Thanks, Jason. Just one clarification and then one comment for possible additional inclusion into question 5, where it says, did you experience any issues? And this, you'll understand why I'm mentioning this with my comment. I think it may be more clear if you said the respondent instead of you. And then the thing that I thought, and I can happily send this via email if it's useful, but I think it may be important to include a small caveat that this wouldn't include any delay from the respondent or the registrant forwarding its receipt of the notice to its representative. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Brian. Those are good points. I think it might be helpful. Go ahead.
Sorry, this is Ariel from staff. George Kirikos also raised his hand.
Go ahead, George.
George Kirikos for the transcript. Going back to page 1, I noticed it didn't ask which URS provider was used. I think that's a question that the practitioner should be asked, because otherwise, when they answer the question, how is your experience with the process of a URS proceeding, they're not, the answer might differ depending on which provider was used. For example, do the supplemental rules at one provider, or just the user interface at one provider. So it would probably make sense to collect that information as part of the survey, as question three, right below question three, or above question three. Thanks.
Thank you, George. So I guess at this point, staff will be taking notes, and we'll be able to incorporate these into any further discussions. But those are important topics, so thank you for that. Any other questions or points to discuss before we move on to the next set of questions?
This is Ariel from staff, and Renee has a question in the comments for number four.
In the chat? Okay, hold on. Renee, do you want to speak to your points, or
sure.
You're just satisfied with it? Okay.
It got split into two pieces because I'm sorry, I'm not used to this format either.
No, we're all having growing pains with the WebEx system, but we'll get through it.
My only concern with question four, I think it's a good question, but the complainant wouldn't necessarily know because they're not responsible for the service on respondent. So I think that we should take that into account when we ask the question. Knowing that they wouldn't necessarily know, but maybe ask it in the way that I put it in the chat. Are you aware of any issues that respondent may have had in receiving the notice? Because it may come up in a response, which then means they have received it, but I don't know how else the complainant would necessarily know if there were issues with the delivery of the notice.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Julie, we have, questions 6, 7, 8, 9? Okay. Brian? Looks like you have your hand up, Brian.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. It's Brian here. I wonder if, I think this was raised during the meeting in Puerto Rico, but I could be mistaken. Maybe a 6A or a new 7 could be, have you chosen not to appeal a URS determination, and then I don't know if it would be also useful to have a blank spot for people to inform us why they wouldn't have done that if they haven't.
Okay, thanks, Brian. I believe, I'm not sure if we dealt with something along those lines later on, but we'll take note of that. There were some areas where you could explain, why you, well, we know we have questions about why you chose not, may not have chosen to use the URS, but we can certainly incorporate appellate procedures. George, it looks like you have your hand up.
Yeah, George Griffiths again. Some of these questions seem to not differ between whether one was the complainant or the respondent. Going back to even the earlier questions, question three, you probably want to collect that data in terms of the process. The experience might have been extremely positive if one was a complainant versus the extremely negative if one was a respondent. So the answer might differ depending on whether one was a complainant or a respondent. So you might want to have either multiple parts of section three, the experience when you were a complainant, it was positive. When you're respondent, it was negative, et cetera. So that's not really being collected at the moment. So that should probably be modified. And that there goes to the later questions as well for the appeal. If the appeal process is not conditioned on whether one was the appellant or the trademark holder responding to the appeal, then it's not really capturing that level of detail properly. Thanks.
Thanks, George. Some of this could be informed by the way we're looking to try to structure this, and this gets back to some discussions we've had with staff. When we do get through this process and actually are implementing the questions, part of what we'll be doing is, of course, tracking who's getting the responses, who's getting the questionnaire. We'll know via email. We'll also be tracking who's responding. That data will be hidden, isn't it? But at the staff level, whoever is receiving this information would be able to determine whether this is a a response coming from a respondent or respondent's counsel and a response coming from complainant or complainant's counsel. So we will be able to, at some level, have understanding of and be able to, you know, collect that data in a way that's meaningful. But sure, your point is taken.
This is Ariel from staff. Petter Rinforce also raised his hand.
Go ahead, Petter.
Hi, Petter here. Going back to Brian's question, if I understand correctly, I think what you referred to is actually on the last page, what we have called other questions, and the question number one, if you choose not to file a U.S. in a particular matter, what was the reason? And then we have A, B, C, D, and some possibilities to make comments. I think that what you asked for.
Thanks, Petter. Yes, I think, you know, I think we indicated that would cover this topic. I think Brian may have been asking maybe to expand that question to address whether or not appeals were filed from a decision. But yes, that last question, if everybody will see, and we'll get to it on the last page, a lot of thoughts went into how that question is worded and to ensure that there's valuable feedback on whether or not the U.S. process was utilized. Is it effective? If you chose not to file a URS, why did you do so? And of course, we're sensitive to the fact that we don't want you to be violating client confidentiality or privilege issues in providing your response, but those that are able to articulate it and choose to will hopefully have some good feedback there. Okay. Staff, I don't know. I don't see any more hands up. If you do, we can move on the document there. Okay.
I'm sorry. Susan Payne just raised her hand.
Go ahead, Susan. Susan?
Sorry. I couldn't find out how to unmute myself. I was holding off because I wasn't sure that we'd really covered question seven, but it seemed like we're moving on. So stop me if I'm speaking too early. But I just thought on question seven, it would be maybe helpful to include some similar wording to what we've got in question three, where in question three we say, you know, how was your experience leaving aside the result of the proceeding? And if we're asking a similar sort of question about an appeal process, I thought it would be useful to have that same kind of caveat of, you know, we're not asking you whether you're happy with the result, but, you know, we're asking you how you experienced the proceeding.
Okay. Thank you. All right. On screen, are we getting, I can't see if we're having, if we're reaching question seven in this next section. Okay, yes, so here we are on screen. If you'll see, we're getting into some topics, question six, seven, eight. That's the appellate process, then de novo review, where this may relate to Brian's questions or concerns about is there, you know, appellate discussion. We can probably get there. Any questions on questions 6, 7, 8, or 9 before we get into this next subsection of substantive issues? I see Susan's hand up. Scott, your hand is up. Susan, is that from before?
Comment. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Scott.
Okay, great. For the question that was asked earlier about, you know, respondent versus complainant and whether or not that needs to be further granularized or made specific, it seems to me that was one of the reasons we chose to use the first two questions to identify the perspective of who's filing it. And the problem, too, is that there could be counsel, if it's a practitioner, that have represented both complainant and or respondent, but to at least get some kind of quantitative understanding of how many proceedings they may have participated in for each side, if you will, or each party, if you will. And that in addition to those, that would, I believe, shed some light on the responses that follow, whether they're on behalf of counsel or a particular party, in which particular role. There is question 10, which we're going to get to, that essentially allows them to expand on their answers, that if they would like to identify, you know, which answer is from a complainant perspective and which answer is from a respondent perspective. Just wanted to make a note of that.
Thank you, Scott. And further to that point, while not for the topic of this call, we did go through at some length, and you may recall at the Puerto Rico meeting, discussion of the practitioners and creating a list of practitioners. And as we found, very few practitioners have represented respondents in these proceedings. And if memory serves me correct, I think we only have one or two practitioners that actually represented respondents in URS proceedings. So this may not be something that by its design and by nature, it may, because of the way the URS is structured, this just may be something where we have a lot of feedback from complainants counsel and very little from the other side. Looks like Brian's hand is up. Brian, is that an old hand or?
It's new. Thanks, Jason. Just a very minor comment on questions 7 and 9, just for parity with question 3 on the first page, it may be worth thinking about some language to the effect of leaving aside the result of the proceeding. Thanks.
Thanks, Brian. Okay, I don't see any other questions. So let's move to substantive issues, staff. That would be the next subsection of questions. Thank you. Okay, as you can see here, we begin to get into some more thorny issues concerning the URS. As you can see, four and five get into implementation, of course, and relief. We felt it important to require additional response and textual response, especially in question five, so that we could understand what the basis is for, you know, determining whether the relief is adequate or inadequate. Likewise, we move on to, I believe, next page would be question 7. Right, 7 and 8. You'll notice we get into the topic of the clear and convincing standard, and 7 and 8 work together. As you can see, you have your ABCD option on 7 and the same for 8. And then if you are arguing for lowering the standard or changing the standard, you'd have to provide a basis or position. Likewise, if you wanted to make it a stronger standard, same requirement to provide some textual response. Susan?
Yeah, thanks, Jason. I had a comment on question 3, if you don't mind, of this
question. Sure.
And that's the one that says, do you believe the URS is being used for the types of cases for which it was intended? And I may be reading, or I may be being too concerned about the nuances of the language, but it seems to me that you could have a URS being used for a type of case for which it wasn't intended, and in which case one would anticipate the claimant would be unsuccessful. And that would be fine, if you like. I'm assuming what you're trying to elicit is whether there's feeling that it's being used to decide cases that for which whether cases that it are being decided using the URS are the ones for which it was intended. Is that right, or were you not trying to elicit that?
So, Susan, to your, I guess to your point, I mean, I think I don't recall the genesis of this question, but we, I believe we, it was in, as it's stated, it, you know, it is just a question going to is the URS being used for its intended purpose, clear cases of abuse, right? So, whether or not the panel is handling it in a proper manner is a different point, but. Your point is taken. I don't think this question was intended to deal with both issues. I think we do. I think we get into, you know, issues in the other questions about how panelists are handling and how these cases have been decided. You know, in a number of other questions without stating it the way you did. But that was not the intention here, to my knowledge. I don't know if Scott, George, or Petter have any further. Comment on this third question three and Susan's question. Okay. No.
This
no
is
other
Ariel from
yes.
Jeff. There's a question from Claudio in the chat. Can we add a question about the general availability of the URS? For example, should be extended to all GTLDs?
Okay, thank you, Claudio.
And
Susan?
George Kirikos.
Okay, looks like Susan and George. Susan, then George, go ahead.
Thanks. Whilst I've got no objection whatsoever, in the sense that I'd love, you know, I'm probably on the side that thinks it would be no bad thing to extend the URS, I'm not sure what the benefit is of asking the practitioners this question. I mean, that's very much an opinion question. So unless there's some particular question that we want to ask about, you know, the appropriateness of the procedure for working for all cases or something, which I'm not sure what Claudia has in mind, but it seems to me we don't need to go out and ask practitioners whether we should be extending this to other TLDs. I think that's the job of our working group to make that determination when we've got all the information back, isn't it?
Thank you, Susan. Speaking as just a working group member here, I do agree with you, Susan, on that point. And I think obviously we raised it at the top of the call with Phil, and we've seen the emails going around whether or not all of our work is going to be utilized or postponed. So I think it is a fair point to consider as a wider working group issue down the road, depending on what we decide with respect to the URS. And I'm not sure how helpful it would be to ask practitioners, even if we do decide to move forward with all this great work now in some fashion. I'm not sure it will asking a practitioner a yes or no question or you know a short question of whether we should expand to other TLDs is appropriate. For what we're looking to do in this document. Greg, looks like, oh, we have George and then Greg.
George Kirikos here. Yeah, I just want to agree with Susan on that we should be in the fact-collecting business, not the opinion-collecting business. My main comment is with regards to point number six, where it asks about educating practitioners. I'm not sure if it's this number six or I can't find the question right now, but there was something about the guidance document about the WIPO overview. I can't find that question.
Yes.
Actually,
okay, we had two questions that go to that. One was should we have something along the lines of the WIPO guide to practitioners for URS? And then there's this question six of providing more guidance on the how you meet the standard or how the clear and convincing standard is met and what it really means.
Right. Yeah, my question was whether the practitioners are actually able to search the historic decisions themselves properly with the current state of the decision history. For example, WIPO has a lot more detailed search engine capability on their site to drill down by the to find decisions related to certain types of situations, which I don't think the forum provides as well. So basically a question to the practitioners whether they are able to, you know, research the historic decisions in an effective manner. I know a lot of people probably use search engines like udrpsearch.com, which is now defunct, for their past research, and you know, the practitioners might want to have a central repository of all the decisions so that they can be effectively searched. Thanks.
Thanks, George. Greg, it looks like you wanted to follow up.
Hi, Greg Shannon, for the record. Yes. I think the I just wanted to say what I said in the chat, which if we wanted to ask at all about the URS and all GTLDs, to ask a more fact-based question, would, if the URS were available in all GTLDs, would you use it? So, we, you know, in terms of complainants and their attorneys, we would, you know something about the desire or of up for or the market for it, if you will. It seems like an opportunity to ask that question. But on the other hand, I understand it can be a loaded topic, not necessarily a loaded question. So if we if we want to hold that whole issue off to some other time, if we think we're going to have another chance to ask providers questions or practitioners questions, we can hold it for another time. But if this is our one bite of the apple, then maybe this is the time to do it. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Well, I guess, you know.
Claudia, can I get in the chair? I'm sorry, I'm listening to the reason.
Sure, Claudia, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. And just to clarify, I might not have phrased the question as skillfully as it could have been, but, you know, one of the features, if we're looking at the URS as a rights protection mechanism, one of its features is that it's limited to new GTLDs and TLDs that have added it to their operations through their contractual agreement with ICANN. There are obviously a few legacy domains that have done that, but generally it is just applicable to the new GTLDs. And so really it's to look into whether, from the practitioner's perspectives who are dealing with abusively registered domains, whether that particular feature of the mechanism is something that could be changed. Is there value in changing it from their perspective? That was really what I was trying to get at there.
Okay. Thank you, Claudio. It looks like Petter, your hand is up. Is that to respond to this?
Yeah, Petter here. And thanks. I'm good to be the last one, because what I wanted to make just a quick summary. It's good to have comments and questions on the questions we have created. And once again, please remember that we started with a great number of questions that was also very generally phrased from the start, asking people to write some novels in their replies. So what we tried to do was to cut down the questions to a more convenient questionnaire, and in doing so, there may be that we lost some of the identifications or specifications. So I appreciate the comments we can get from your now when you read through the questions and think that, well, you don't understand the question, or is it really covering a specific topic that you wanted to, from the start, to have in this questionnaire. On the other hand, I think we don't need to add the number of questions or make it more general, but if there is a specific need to further clarify, that's perfect, and thanks for that.
Thanks, Petter. And yes, to that point, I mean, I think if everybody at some point, if you can print out the document and read it in its entirety, and think about it as if you were answering the questions yourself as a practitioner, I believe you'll find that the document satisfies 99% of what we're discussing here. Well, hopefully 100%, but certainly it's a high percentage. I think we, once you read it through and actually consider how all the questions interrelate, I know it's a bit disjointed when looking on the WebEx. I think it'll satisfy most of the questions. I think we've also gotten some great feedback today, and I'm actually pleased that it's been very little feedback in terms of requiring or requesting changes. So it looks like we're in a pretty good shape. So I thank everybody for their participation on that point. Obviously, the questions that are raised that would expand, some points that Greg is getting to and Claudio and others, I guess that's also a question for Phil and Kathy and the wider working group as to do we really go into that territory today. Yes, we know that URS and expansion of URS to legacy TLDs is a topic and is something that will certainly be discussed in the future. Whether we open that door now or not is a fair question. So, but yes, we will certainly have opportunity to deal with that. That's for sure.
Phil has his hand raised.
Phil?
Yeah, Phil, for the record, thanks for leading this discussion, Jason. It's been, as you noted, most of the, not a lot of suggestions for radical changes to the questions. On Claudio's suggestion about asking about whether URS and in essence should be consensus policy, I don't object to adding that. It's a little different. We're trying to get practitioners feedback on their actual experience with URS, but of course, if they the target group to answer this is the ones who've used it, so it's useful input. But the policy question on whether any of the new TLD RPM should become consensus policy is really only relevant to two of them, not one of which is the URS, not some of the ones that are tied to the opening of a new TLD. It's a policy question for this full working group, and it's fine to get practitioners' opinion on that. I suspect most lawyers, if you ask them, would you like one more possible tool in your toolbox, will say, sure, why not, but particularly if they brought the action. But we can get into that in our discussion in a couple of weeks on whether we want to ask for a charter change, because one of the considerations is that if we put off policy decisions on URS until phase two, I've assumed, I guess it can be debated, that that would mean postponing any recommendation on it becoming or not becoming consensus policy, because we wouldn't know what it's going to be until the end of phase two and whether there's been significant changes in it, which would be pretty relevant to whether it should be available against 150 million plus legacy domains. But we'll deal with that on the call discussing the suggestion to change the timing of URS decisions. Other than that, good job, and I'll let you get back to it.
Thank you, Phil. And, you know, just to remind everyone that's on this call, and we'll, of course, be dealing with the data collection and presentation later, one thing we were sensitive to try to avoid, and Phil touched on that, is to make sure we have good data points coming back to us on their experience with the ERS. The other thing is worth noting, even if we do add questions, if we look at our practitioners list, if we have 75 or so practitioners that we're going to be sending this to, we wanted to avoid getting, just skewed, wholly skewed responses where in this case, you'd probably get 75 yes answers. While that may be useful, if we would have to also temper that by saying, well, this was sent to, 74 complainants counsel and one respondents counsel. I'm making that number up for the illustrative purposes, but it's not that far off. So as far as getting a useful response to that question, I think we we may be in a, you know, we may just want to make sure that if we do include that question, that, you know, when we review the data, it may not be particularly informative.
George Kirikos raised his hand.
Yeah.
George, go ahead.
Thanks. George Kirikos for the transcript. Yeah, I just want to follow up on that skewing topic. That's a very important thing, because if you, for example, ask the 100 users of a highway that only 100 people use, whether they, you know, like that highway, even though it costs, you know, say, billions of dollars, it's not counting the opinion of all the people, the opportunity cost of that highway. So there are obviously costs and benefits to these procedures that are outside the actual people being surveyed. One thing that I noticed, which we didn't seem to capture anywhere in the question so far, is the practitioners aren't being asked questions with regards to the number of court cases they've brought with regards to cyber squatting, because the entire purpose of the URS was basically to provide a more cost-effective procedure compared to the courts. And so we should be trying to collect data on, you know, have these people filed court cases? What are the number of court cases they've got? You know, what are the number of court cases that have been diverted, or, you know, been diverted to the URS instead of having to go to court? And so if there's like a cost savings, we're not capturing that anywhere here. So I'd want to make that as a general suggestion, you know, if we look at the overriding concern of the URS, you know, as an alternative dispute resolution mechanism, we wanted to collect data on, you know, what's the primary, you know, dispute resolution mechanism, i.e. the courts. So I don't see that being captured anywhere here. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, George. So your question is going to a broader point of what has a practitioner decided to do with their clients' trademarks and how they proceeded with all of the avenues that are available to them. You know, as you see, we do get into questions one or two regarding, you know, how many URS proceedings you've been involved in, and then later on we do get into the questions of whether or not you chose the URS as a rights protection process. We were sensitive to not get into attorney-client issues or work product issues in terms of those determinations. This question might get into that a bit if I were a trademark practitioner and saying and revealing how or why I may have chosen to go to court or file a UDRP or file a URS. I think that's a sensitive issue that we do. Yeah, you know, we want to temper that. Obviously, I think counsel would not want to necessarily reveal their strategies, but your point is certainly taken.
This is Ariel. I'm from staff. We have two hands raised. One is from Georges Nasi-Chinlinski. The other is from Greg.
Go ahead, George.
Hi, George Nasi-Chinlinski for the record. So the issue with this that question that George raises is that it's really an issue if you're going to look at UDRP, people who have filed UDRPs, practitioners who have filed court cases and whatnot. The limited, this survey was meant to go to URS practitioners, and we designed it to be people who use the URS to give us feedback. If we're now going to go into the avenue of, like, you know, what have they done in terms of court filings and whatnot, you're creating a very skewed universe. You have a subset because you don't have all the people who practice in this area commenting on what they've done or not done.
Thank you, George. Greg? Greg Shatton, are you there?
Hi, Greg Shatton. For the record, I found that you cannot have the chat up and unmute at the same time. Rather inconvenient. In any case, my concerns are along the same lines as George raised and that Brian raised in the chat. I also fundamentally don't characterize this as an alternative to bringing a court case, but rather probably most primarily to bringing a UDRP, probably at least, you know, given that it's for slam dunks, probably not the ones where court cases would be likely to be brought, but who knows? And there's so many different ways, as Brian Beckham mentioned, you know, there are a lot of different arrows in the quiver, everything from negotiated sales through actions through cease and desist letters, you know, making other arrangements to have the site, if there's infringing use, to get rid of the infringing use rather than necessarily the domain, if the domain is one that could also be put to legitimate non-infringing purposes. That, and also, I think if you look at the practitioners that we're asking, many of them do not appear to necessarily be kind of full-service domain dispute practitioners. A number appear to be kind of brand protection companies that maybe they're going to get into URS or UDRP, but they would not be bringing court cases at all, just by nature of their of who they appear to be. So I think that kind of gets us off into a really whole separate level of question here. And I think we cover the basic issue adequately with the question we asked about whether we whether the practitioner believes that the URS is being used, you know, for its intended purpose. To ask whether, you know, they considered a UDRP in any given case, or whether they, how many UDRPs they filed. There may be people who try to avoid doing UDRPs at all, you know, in any event, and others who, you know, file them, you know, three times before breakfast. Really, you know, it's a kind of the whole concept of how one decides to deal with this issue in any particular event is driven by so many concerns, the practitioner in question, the client in question, the mark in question, the domain string in question, the TLD in question. I just don't think we're going to get anything really useful unless we had a very narrowly crafted, very factual question, and then we'd have to deal with all kinds of skew issues because, again, of the population that we're asking. Thanks. I think I would just, you know, not ask it, basically. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. And I guess, you know, I also agree with Greg's point there as well, just as a member of the group. But again, you know, let's go back to the intent and purpose of why we're doing this document and presenting these questions. And I think if we can come to consensus on that and understand the intent and purpose of what we're doing and ask the question, does this document achieve that? Hopefully the answer would be in the affirmative, and yes, it does achieve that. We're getting valuable feedback about the URS itself, but I can leave it there. Any other points, questions, concerns?
George Nakichaminsky's hand still raised, but not sure whether it's old or new.
It's an old hand. I'll take it down. Sorry.
Thanks, George. Anyone else? I don't see any hands. Staff, do you see any hands? No hands. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. I think it was a valuable feedback, and I think we made some great progress, so I appreciate everybody's time and assistance here. I can turn it back to you, Phil and Kathy.
Yeah, Jason, I don't know if you're about to leave. Before you go, we haven't finished this document yet, have we?
As far as running through it?
Yeah, have we gone through the whole thing?
I believe we get to the last page, which is page 6. We can quickly put that on screen. We went through the burden of proof, the adequacy of the process.
Yeah, Julie had one saying no, but
okay,
that's
okay.
Okay,
let's go to that page. That's fine. No, let's do it. So, I mean, we have that last page right there.
Okay, can you stay? If we have just one.
Yeah, I can. I can. Yeah, I can. I can hold for a bit.
Yeah, if you got 10 more minutes, let's finish this. Then we can start on providers, and I've got some thoughts on how we can expedite the providers' questions review, because clearly we're not going to complete that today. But let's go ahead and finish the last page of this and get done with this document.
Okay, it looks like we've got. Hopefully, everybody can see the last few questions. It looks like we have Brian, Kathy, and Zhao. Heng Zhao. So I guess let's start with Brian.
Yeah, hi. Sorry to take us backwards. I was looking at the chat and we were kind of whizzing through the last few pages. I had two extremely practical suggestions on the question practical issues number one. It's about the current mechanisms for proving use. I appreciate that this is to practitioners who have either used it or have considered using it, but I thought just reading this kind of with a fresh set of eyes myself today, I thought it might be useful to list out what those mechanisms for proving use are, just to refresh people's memories when they're doing the survey. And then sticking with the section of practical issues, question number six, a kind of a similar comment just to list out the different types of avenues for filing. So there was just literally listing response, appeals, de novo review, just again to refresh people's memories when they're answering the questions as to the time frame, so they could provide us with more specific data as to which particular time frame they thought may be worth reconsidering. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Brian. So that's question six, which I see and understand your point. And the other one was question one, or in practical issues, or where were you? Yes, was that question one?
That's right, question one. So just to list the various means of proving use may be useful to refresh people's memories.
Got it. Okay. Kathy?
Jason, this is Kathy Kleiman, and I had a question about procedurally how the subteam wants to move forward. And I'm asking, I was also a member of the subteam, but I thought maybe kind of next steps after we get to the end of the discussion of the questions, next steps with SurveyMonkey and other things might be a
sure
overview for the working group. Thanks.
Okay. Heng Zhao? Is your hand still
okay
up?
Okay. Could you hear me?
Yes.
I have one. This is Johan, and for the record, and I have a very specific suggestion. It's about the question three in procedures. Question is about the filing fee, you know, and I hope we can add some comment here that if you answer the DOE, would you provide an estimate price or fee? No. And we can let the practitioner to add their ideal filing fee here, you know, in question three. Yeah.
Question, okay, yes, yeah, so we're talking about the filing fee.
The filing fee is too high or too low, maybe we can provide a suggestion, right? And I hope we can propose them a chance to write a suggestion here. Yeah.
Okay, perhaps we can allow for the participant to. Yes, understood. Okay, thank you.
Okay, that's all.
George, looks like your hand is up, George.
Yeah, George Rikos for the transcript. Just to go on, follow up on that point, there are actually response fees. When the number of domains in dispute are above a certain number, I think 15 or whatever, in the forum. So a question on that or a subset of number three or a subpart of number three might be appropriate to cover those response fees. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Claudio? Claudio, is your hand raised, or are you just typing in the chat room? Okay. Okay, thank you. I guess at this point we now have reached the end of the questionnaire. We're going to, if everybody has seen the last page and we can move on. If anybody has any questions, I guess we can get to Kathy's point on next steps and how we can proceed as a sub-team and how we intend to move forward. Kathy?
Sure, I'd be happy to summarize, Jason. This is Kathy Kleiman, and the sub-team wanted to suggest to the working group that we would be happy to continue working as a sub-team and working with staff, and so that kind of next steps would be next steps we propose for this once it's finalized is staff would set up questions on SurveyMonkey. The forum, Renee, has volunteered, which we appreciate, to help us work with reaching the practitioners in going through and doing the research, which we did on hundreds of cases in the URS. We sometimes found the practitioner was identified. We sometimes found that they weren't, that the law firm was identified. And so who and how to reach people is somewhat of a question, but Renee has probably she offered to work with us. So if there's no objections, we would probably work with the forum to reach the practitioners. Some of the practitioners we all know, Doug, for example, Doug Eisenberg, but many we don't. And then the sub-team would volunteers to put the results of the survey together, not to analyze them, but more to compile answers, because we could be getting up to 60 results if people really respond to kind of this short, succinct survey that people have worked so hard on in the sub-team. So that is what we wanted to put forward as a procedural way forward to the working group, and then provide the working group with the detailed results as well as summary results of what happens in the survey. Thank you.
Thank you. George?
One last question. Is this survey going to be an anonymous survey, or is this going to be one where we actually collect the names and identity of those responding? Because one can perhaps expect slightly different results or responses depending on whether it's an anonymous versus an non-anonymous survey.
Right.
Thank you.
So at this stage, as Kathy explained, our intent is to work, to provide, we would do two things, right? We would work with, among the subgroup and with the forum to identify the contact information for all of the participants. We anticipated making sure that there was some identifying measure, making sure that an email was tied to the response and that, you couldn't respond again. But we wanted to decouple that information and make sure that that information wasn't necessarily revealed beyond the response, right? So we wouldn't tie it up and identify you as the respondent in the to the wider group or to the people reviewing the data necessarily. So it would be anonymized in that sense, but we would know who responded at the higher level. And in order to be in compliance with GDPR, of course, we have to be cognizant of that too. No, I'm joking, half joking. But okay. Any other questions?
Jason, it's Claudia.
Claudio, go ahead.
Hey, sorry, I got dropped off earlier. I just had I put in the chat. I was just wondering if we had a general question, like a catch-all question, where the practitioners could provide input on what they see as any sort of general advantages or limitations to the RPM.
So we do have a couple of sections for catch-alls, and I think. Nothing that is actually keying in on your point, right? But we do have added, please provide any additional comments to your questions above. I think it actually is a catch-all in each section. So we do allow for, further expansion. And I guess, that your question may lend itself in a certain section or another, but we don't have a specific point saying what you just articulated.
Yeah, I mean, because I think the questions, I think you guys did a great job in identifying specific issues where you know, we want feedback, but I was just thinking there might be things we might have missed or just things and, you know, maybe if we just have a question in there that isn't sort of bound in any way to a particular topic, where we just sort of ask in general terms if there's any additional views that they might have on the advantages and limitations of the policy.
Okay. Thank you, Claudio. We can certainly note that. I think, as I said before, I think that we do allow for that in each section, and I think as you go through the questions or as you were as a questionnaire, as someone being questioned, as a participant, you would naturally at some point say, hey, wait a second, I want to spend more on this point. But if you're looking for a final, at the end of the entire document, a text box to allow you to, you know, pontificate about your feelings with URS, we can certainly raise that as an issue. I don't know if it fits necessarily structurally with the SurveyMonkey structure to allow, and then I guess the question would become a word limit, right? Are we inviting people to write pages and pages and volumes of material, and is that really what the point of this is? But your point is taken, so it's certainly something to consider.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Jason, this is Phil. Thank you very much for taking us through this, and to you and all the members of the sub-team for the very hard work and thought that obviously went into this. So thank you, and I'm going to take the call back over now and run through some things. So thanks, Jason.
Thank you, Phil.
We've got 20 minutes left on this call, so clearly we're not going to get through providers. So I want to talk about procedure going forward and how to expedite things. So those of you who are in San Juan will know that moving PDP working groups forward more expeditiously is a big aim and concern for GNSO Council. There was robust discussion in San Juan about how to do that, and that's kind of a backdrop for what I'm going to talk about now, and these are we've just finished a review of the questions for practitioners. There's 40-plus of us on this call, but that's not the full working group membership, so I'm going to ask staff to send out the questions with any adjustments made as a result of today's comment to the full working group membership as soon as possible, with a cover note that these questions were fully discussed on today's call, that for members of the working group who weren't able to participate, we're going to hold things open. I would suggest 1 week till next week's call for further input on them. If people think questions need to be rephrased or other things have to be done with them or questions added, to get that in by next Wednesday call time, and after that we're going to finalize these questions so we can get them out to the practitioners and get answers back by the end of May. I want to talk about the timelines we're under here. We want to get the questions to practitioners and to providers out by early May so we can have answers back by late May, early June, to give us time, noting that there's no call the week before the Panama City ICANN meeting, to begin some initial analysis of what the answers mean or what they suggest so we can have informed discussions in Panama City. I saw a question in the chat, how much time will we have in Panama City? We're going to have many hours in Panama City. The final schedule isn't set yet, but policy meeting, and we're going to have a great deal of time, but we need to lay the proper groundwork for our face-to-face discussion. So one timeline and time pressure we're acting under is the need to get these questions out by the first week of May so that we can get answers back by late May, early June, and have some discussion of those answers before we all head many of us head to Panama. Other time pressures. We've got a active working group discussion of whether we want to ask counsel for a charter change. As I noted at the beginning of the call, Kathy and I have tentatively agreed that that call to discuss that suggestion and see where we are on that as a working group should take place on the first call in May to give us time to finish up some of this work on the questions, but also to see if there is sufficient support. We can decide how to tee that up. If we're going to send something to council, we want to get that done before the 10-day document deadline for their that closes out what they can address on their call at the end of May. So we have that time pressure. Another thing is that Brian has indicated to the co-chairs that he's interested in accepting that nomination that was placed on the list to be a co-chair, and I thank him for that willingness and that he's preparing a statement for the full working group to consider, and it's practice to carve out some time so that working group members can ask questions of anyone who wants to assume a leadership position before we make a decision as a group on that. And that's also a time pressure with council, because while a new co-chair can act in an interim capacity, they can't fully assume the role without council signing off on that. So that's another deadline for council consideration in May. So we've got all that going on. And Claudia, I see your hand up, and let me just say one more thing before I take your comment, if that's a new hand. We've got, you'll see on the tabs above, we've got two things that start with the word providers. One, it's the one further to the right, is responses to proposed questions to URS providers. This will show you where we had proposed questions and discovered that either between the discussion we had in San Juan or other feedback we've gotten from the providers, mostly in preparation for that session, we already have a lot of those questions answered, and there's no need to ask them again. We don't want to burden the providers with asking them to tell us the same answer they already gave us. So that document is not one that requires a great deal of discussion on a working group call, but I would ask you all to review it. And if you think in any case that we need to expand the question or that the answers are insufficient, we need to include it in some way on what's going out to the providers rather than deleting it from the questions we're preparing for them, get back to us on the email list. And all of that will be fed to the sub-team members on providers for consideration and some feedback to this full working group. Similarly, moving to the other thing that's starts with providers. That's the consolidated questions to URS providers as of 17th of April, which is yesterday. You will note that this is a 12-page document, and it's somewhat more complex than the document we just went through. So if we follow the same procedure that we just followed for the practitioners' questions, we're going to be devoting several working group calls to this and miss our deadline for getting it out in early May. So I'm going to, I hope it's not burdensome, but it's your choice. We can either do this collectively as a group, which means everyone has to listen to everyone else, bring up sometimes minor suggestions for tweaking questions or arcane points, or we can ask all of you and all working group members, and this can go out after today's call as well, to review the questions, and if you have any concerns about any question or any suggestion for rephrasing it or any belief that some question that should be asked hasn't been asked in this 12-page document, get it to the working group list. I'm going to ask you to all do that by close of business Friday so it can be fed to the sub-team members for consideration. And if we do that, we can come back with an amended document next week, which includes a lot of those suggestions, and save a lot of time for everybody. So it's your choice, but if you probably put an hour's work into reviewing this and generating questions, it can probably save us many hours of working together on the call. So, and the last thing I'm going to say, and I don't see any hands up right now, is I just want to tell you how these questions were generated. These questions were generated through very intense review by the sub-team members, the provider sub-team members. We went through the URS rules, rule by rule. We went through the procedures, procedure by procedure. We went through the technical requirements, and we went through every provider supplemental rules. That's the work reflected in this document. It's a tremendous amount of work that's gone into it, and we went through every piece of that with basically saying, all right, what questions does this rule or does this procedure naturally generate that we want to ask providers about? So that's how the document came to be. That's the background on what we have here. So that's about what I – the last thing, and I'll Brian's preparing a report on it, on the documents group. I don't believe the documents group is it fed into these two efforts on providers and practitioners questions. The remaining stuff is data they prepared on the appeals cases, and then there are some other data that we can look at on the cases that were decided that where the claim was denied. They were decided in favor of the respondent. So that's basically information for us to consider that would feed into policy considerations if we get to that, whenever we get to that, whether it's phase one or phase two. So I see Brian's hand up. I've said a lot. I'm going to review the chat while Brian is speaking and see if folks are okay with the way I've proposed on the fly here to move us forward in a thorough but expeditious manner. So, Brian, go ahead, and then I see George's hand up.
Thanks, Phil. Brian Beckham, for the record. I just wanted to mention that I can directly for the document subteam work with staff, but just wanted to mention that there were two questions that we as a subteam were proposing to refer up to the provider's subteam. I looked through the document earlier. I believe one is already covered. It concerns communications with registries. There was another one about any observed anomalies with the processes. I wasn't sure if that was quite captured. So if everyone agrees, maybe I can, for the document subteam, work with staff to just make sure that the two points that the subteam on documents was going to refer up to the provider's subteam is already integrated into that document for people to consider when it goes out to the working list. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, Brian. And George, I see your hand up. Before you speak, I do want to note that in the chat, my suggestion for getting comments on the consolidated providers' questions in was spurred by the very thorough document you provided to the working group list a little earlier before this call started, and that spurred my suggestion that other members take a look at these questions, and if they believe that to send any input to the full working group list so that the sub-team members can consider that, and we can possibly come back with an amended list of questions next week. And if we decide that any suggestion is one that we don't want to accept without fuller working group discussion, we'll indicate that as well. But so go ahead, George, and then I'll call on my co-chair, Kathy.
George Kirikos here. Yeah, I just want to say that other people who prepared for today's call probably did the same thing. They made notes while they read the documents. So it's just a matter of typing up those notes if they haven't already done so, so that they could send us a list and the sub-team could work on it. My concern is, if we set a deadline for, say, Friday for people to respond to that, that's tomorrow, I guess, will there be enough time for the sub-team to meet in advance of next week's call, scheduled call, for the main group, but still also have an updated document that we can review to see how those changes were reflected? Because otherwise we're back into the same kind of scenario where we'd be getting an updated document maybe mere hours before the next call and not have a time to review it and review the changes. Like if there's like a redline version of the document that's produced also, that would be important. Thanks.
Yeah, well, George, actually, the reason I suggested Friday thinking on the fly is, of course, today is Wednesday. So Friday is, COB Friday is 2.5 days away. I thought that was enough time for working group members who can find a spare hour to go through these questions. And then that can be forwarded at the end of Friday to sub-team members with an ask that they take a look at the suggestions and get back on with any comments to the rest of the sub-team members by close of business Monday, and that would allow staff to get a consolidated document out Tuesday. I know it's quick, but again, I think we want to try to expedite in any way possible here and go as fast as we can. We're not going to put out an incomplete document, but I'm just looking for ways to consolidate different things and not have everything take place on a 90-minute call every week when a lot of things can take place. We don't need a sub-team call, I don't think, to consider that input. The sub-team's been doing a lot of work just by its dedicated email list. And Kathy, you had your hand up.
Great, Phil. I think you covered a lot of what I was going to say, but I also wanted to thank all the sub-teams. Everyone's been working very hard. Everyone's been working in parallel. And, you know, your sub-team, the URS providers, 12 pages of questions, is phenomenal. So I think the deadlines you've provided would make sense, if we all work quickly, in light of what the GNSO Council would like us to do. Also, I just wanted to double-check what the timeframes were for Brian's materials and the documents sub-team. And just lay those out again. And maybe staff can just put together a quick calendar for it. And as the sub-teams come back, maybe they can do what practitioners did and just include a few notes of procedurally what they recommend to the working group as the next steps, whether they want to kind of continue with compilations, et cetera, or whether they want that to come back to the full working group. Thanks, Phil.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Kathy. Good suggestion. So I think some of this we can do after the call, working with staff. So, you know, having said all that, George has noted that next week's call is in the APEC time slot. We have to deal with that, but, you know, we're going to try to combine doing work by the email list and doing work on the calls. I think you'll find that if you put 30 minutes to an hour in to reviewing these consolidated questions and get any comments in by the email list, it may pay dividends in avoiding many hours of listening on a call when a lot of work can be done by email and doesn't require being done orally. We're not going to cut anything short, but we are looking to for shortcuts here to just be more efficient and productive in our work. So does anyone else have any comments or questions? I kind of covered next week's call is going to be, which is at 1200 UTC, which I think works for the Asia-Pacific people, accommodates the people in Europe. It's not bad for the East Coast of the U.S. It's up on the West Coast people, but no time is perfect. It's going to be our discussion of the providers' questions. We'll figure out what to do with Brian's nomination when we get his statement and when we're going to have that discussion. It would have to be by that first call in May, I think, to get it up before council if there's working group support for him to assume that position. And we've talked about the first call in May being to discuss the proposal to move part or all of the URS decisions to phase two and see if we want to send a communication to council about that they can consider in May. And I talked about all the deadlines we're facing to be ready for Panama. So we're at 2:28, 28 minutes past the hour. If there are no more comments or questions, we can give you back 2 minutes of your day, and you can use those 2 minutes to begin your review of the consolidated questions to URS providers. Okay. Well, I think we're done for today, and we got a lot done, and you have your homework, and we'll be getting emails out to all working group members. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks.
Thank you. Today's meeting is adjourned. Lawrence, the operator, you can disconnect all lines. And to everyone, thank you and have a fantastic day.
Fantastic.